Welcome to the Developer Journey Podcast. My name is Kevin Hazard. I'm a Microsoft C# MVP, and I'll be your host for the show today. Our guests today are Mike Barnett and Manuel Fandrich of Microsoft Corporation. Mike is a research software design engineer at Microsoft, and Manuel serves as the senior researcher on the Microsoft Code Contracts team. Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Let's just get started by talking about what you guys do. The title, for example, Mike, Research Software Design Engineer, what does that mean at Microsoft? What do you do? What's your day like?
So in Microsoft Research, there's two main job titles. There's researchers and there's software design engineers. The difference between the two is very flexible. It depends on the group that people are in. So in our group, we tend to be more project-oriented, and people do, you know, whatever is needed to work on the project. But in general, researchers tend to be more research paper-oriented, perhaps, and academically oriented, and the developers are supposed to be a little more coding-oriented. But in our group, that's just not, I mean, Manuel probably bangs out at least twice as much code as I ever can write. So, I mean, it's just kind of a, we're not real big on titles, and we're not real big on distinctions. We just try to get the work done.
Sure, that makes sense. Titles often don't really tell us what people are all about. So, Manuel, I see that you're very active on the social MSDN site, where there's a lot of threaded discussions about code contract. So you're writing code, as Mike says. You're out there cranking out code, but you're also very active in the community, as it were, sort of talking about code contracts. What's your role on the team? And I'd like you to talk for a minute about your interaction on the social MSDN site and what developers seem to be excited about with respect to code contracts and how they're responding to the release of the product into the framework.
Sure. So I see my role as basically, you know, making sure all the loose ends get eventually tied up and just driving the whole project forward and figuring out what needs to be done and making sure it gets done somehow. The MSDN site, the forum, has been really, really useful for us in terms of getting feedback from actual users and not just, you know, this being a project that we think is cool but no one else cares about. So having feedback and actually being told, well, this needs to be different, or you haven't thought about this issue, and so on, has been very, very useful. And we've actually included a lot of feedback and changed the design over time to accommodate things that have been brought up in the forum. So we're very grateful to all of the users there and all the feedback we get. So I try to be active there, try to figure out, you know, what's working and what's not working. And figure things out on our side to help them. So yeah, that's kind of what I see the social aspect of the forum is good. And I think the feedback overall has been, I would say, overwhelmingly positive, in that people do get excited about having a common way to write contracts in their code, and then that are supported by a set of tools. And I think the fact that the authoring part of the contracts, namely that you can write them, is now in 4.0, is really helping a lot, because people can just start authoring them without having any dependencies on extra libraries and so on. And I think that makes a big difference.
Well, that's good. It's good to hear that people are open to the idea of contracts and code, which sort of leads into my next question. Because some of our listeners and readers aren't familiar with the concept of contracts and code because they read blogs and they watch podcasts or listen to podcasts, and they sort of track things in the business. You know, for example, I know a lot of people just routinely visit the Microsoft Dev Labs and research sites just to see what you guys are working on, and they'll you know, pick up on a project like code contracts and find out that there are really interesting things that they can do within their code. But a lot of people don't necessarily know what code contracts are, or they're not familiar with design by contract languages like Eiffel or SpecSharp. And I was hoping that you guys could take a minute to sort of initiate people who don't really know about code contracts and what they are, and sort of relate that to how they came into being at Microsoft. Why did you guys decide to create code contracts?
Whoa, that's a big question. I guess there's a lot of reasons, and there's a pretty circuitous route to how we got to where we are today. let me just sort of give you a perspective maybe from my side, and then maybe Mike can sort of fill in some of what I'm missing. So my background is actually more in static program analysis, so that would be, you know, tools that try to find errors or prove certain things correct in your code without running the code. And one of the problems that one runs into in that field is always that if you don't have specifications about what the code is supposed to be doing, then it's kind of hard to do this static analysis. And that has several, you know, aspects. One is, well, you have to know what needs to be proven. The other thing is you need to break down the problem of proving an entire program correct into smaller manageable chunks. And so if you write specifications like contracts that are expressing sort of the conditions at boundaries of methods, like preconditions and postconditions, it makes this whole problem more manageable because it breaks it down into smaller pieces that can be done. And so, I mean, one of the motivations from a long time ago that sort of brought us onto this trajectory was essentially having such specifications to make static analysis more amenable. But I think over time we now found that, you know, that's a good thing to shoot for, but it's not necessarily the first thing one wants to do. In fact, we've now sort of tell the story that you should write contracts to document your APIs first and foremost, because, you know, you're never the only person looking at a piece of code or using a piece of code. So having this kind of documentation is very useful. And then once you write that down in a way that machines can actually understand that it's not just a comment, then you can enable tools like runtime checking that actually enforce these contracts at runtime. And then, you know, starting on that route, if you start having a lot of contracts and you want to tie down the correctness of a particular piece of code, you then may want to start trying to use a static analyzer and really get into the sort of very depths of writing specifications.
What's interesting is when I talk to people about code contracts, I'll actually avoid the word documentation during a presentation, for example, to a user group or a code camp or something like that. And almost invariably, within 10 minutes, someone in the audience will recognize, hey, this is like documentation. And that's sort of when the light bulb goes off. I can tell that person gets it, because the idea is that we've got this way of expressing a documentation comment almost that's machine readable. Is that a good way to think about it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I think if you look at it sort of in the broad context of what's happened in the history of computing, there's the trend has always been towards making more things machine checkable. So in the early days when we just did assembly level programming, you know, there weren't even types, right? You just passed registers or values. And type languages made this huge advance where all of a sudden the compiler could give you this benefit by not allowing you to even compile a program that had certain errors in it, such as treating an integer as a string or treating a character as a number. You know, of course, then there's certain restrictions that come with that, and then people fight with those. But overall, I think most people agree that having a type language is a really great advance. And so contracts are just, you can think of it as enriching that type signature. So now you know not only when you call this method do you need to give it an integer, but you know properties about the integer you need to pass it.
Very good. So let's jump from here and talk a little bit about the tools. The tools that ship with code contracts come in a variety of forms, and maybe you could take a moment to talk about runtime tooling and tooling that's available inside Visual Studio, and then maybe differentiate if you can about maybe what pieces had to be put into the CLR to support this, and the kinds of classes and the framework that are there to support it as well.
Okay, so what ships currently in .NET 4.0, the only thing that's in the framework is the contract class itself, which is a class with several static methods, such as requires and ensures, that allow you to write these specifications as part of your .NET program. And because it's a library, it means that you can write these methods no matter what the .NET language is that you're using. So whether you're writing your program in C# or VB, you still call these methods. The expressions you pass them are written in the language that you're writing your program in. So that's the only thing that's actually in the framework. Everything else is an external tool that we've developed over here in research just to show what kinds of things can be done once everyone agrees upon the standardized encoding of code contracts. And so the tools that exist so far are Visual Studio integration, so that your project properties have a pane that let you control the rest of the tools. And then the tools that it controls are the runtime checker, the static checker, and the documentation generation.
One of the questions that comes up all the time for me is, why didn't you make extensions to the C# language or the VB.NET language or any other language to support this?
Well, I think this is not an either-or question. We obviously tried the language right first. So, I mean, you mentioned SpecSharp in the introduction, and so that was a language where it had first-class syntax for contracts and so on. Over time, we noticed that, you know, first of all, you know, starting with a new language is really difficult because people don't necessarily want to change what language they're programming in, right? You know, adding a feature like this to an existing language like C# or VB, that takes a lot of effort. You know, there needs to be a really good case for extending a language. And, you know, the language designers want to see the benefit first. But how can you show that without having the feature there in the first place? So it was sort of a chicken-egg problem, and the approach that we took with code contracts, which is solely based on libraries and external tools, which doesn't need a language change, was effectively to do that step first, to show, okay, there is demand, there are all these cool tools you can write once you have this. And now it doesn't preclude the language like, say, C# or VB to say, hey, yeah, we want to give you nicer syntax for this, right? They could do that and then simply emit whatever format we already have, and then tools can take advantage of that just as well. So I don't think it's an either or. It's really an evolution, I think. We now have things in place, and if the languages want to follow suit and actually give you nicer syntax, they're free to do that.
The other benefit about doing it this way is it's immediately available to all .NET languages. Whereas if we'd gone the language route, you know, we would have had to maybe do one language at a time, and then only the people who program in that language would get the advantages.
Sure. Obviously, being able to do this immediately for C# and Visual Basic in particular is fantastic, without having to negotiate, as you said, all of the things that are necessary to modify a language. You know, languages have inertia, and it works both ways. Objects in motion like to remain in motion, and C# and VB sort of have their own trajectories at this point.
That's correct.
So SpecSharp in particular, is the current shipping version of SpecSharp taking advantage of any of the framework classes in 4.0, for the other framework class, the contracts class that you've exposed, for example? Or is it still sort of proprietary in that respect?
SpecSharp is now, we've released that as open source. That's now on CodePlex as specsharp.codeplex.com. And its existing implementation is still the same as it was when we released it, but we have plans to modify it so that it integrates with the code contracts and uses the code contracts infrastructure instead of its own, instead of what we did originally, which was a ad hoc custom infrastructure for implementing the contract support.
Oh, that's good. You know, one of the other big questions I get when I talk about code contracts is, why did you choose to do this as code? There are some competing frameworks in other languages, like Java, for example. There's a contract for J package that uses metadata to sort of mark classes and methods up, rather than writing what looks like code inside the functions. So in the .NET space, of course, we would sort of imagine putting attributes on a class or putting attributes on a function to specify the contracts. Did you all play with that sort of interface early on, or was it sort of dismissed out of hand as not being a viable option?
I love that question. I think it's definitely a question we get a lot too, and we did put a lot of thought into it, and we had a lot of experience over many years with other approaches, in particular attributes. Basically, attributes are would be an ideal system if they were richer to express what you need to do. The problem is attributes are very restricted in what they can say. and what they can refer to in the code. And if you want to start encoding, full expression language and so on, you end up having to use essentially strings in your attributes to do that, which means you now have to define a new language for that. You have to, teach it to people. You have to compile it. You have to analyze it and so on. Whereas if you take the approach that we took with just writing it in code, you already have the language it's given. It's the language the program is writing in. You have the translation and the semantics of those expressions. It's the language compiler that you're using, which basically takes away of a lot of duplication you would otherwise have to do if I start encoding everything as strings in my attributes. Another sort of advantage of not using attributes is that once you're in the attributes and you're just strings, you have the same problem as if this were just a comment, because you now say you refactor a method and you rename a parameter, right? Well, it won't rename that string which is in the attribute for that parameter, but if it's in the code like it is today, it will rename it properly. So you get a lot of integration from your existing IDE if you write contracts as code, whereas if you write them as attributes or doc, you won't get any of that.
I had the experience of writing an attribute-based security token analyzer that used aspect-oriented programming in the past, and you're exactly right. We had to invent a syntax and teach everyone how to use it, and it was very painful. So it makes sense why you chose that path. So the next question I have is about the tooling again. The static checker is really only available to users of the premium version of Code Contracts. You have a premium version and a standard version, I think you call it. And this really means that the static checker is available to users of the premium and ultimate editions of Visual Studio. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Now, the thinking behind that was I'm trying to get an idea, because people ask me this all the time. They like Code Contracts enough that they would consider upgrading. So it makes me wonder, was the thinking behind the decision so that you would essentially drive people to the premium and ultimate editions of Visual Studio, or was there an assumption that people that would use the Code Contracts product are likely, on the premium edition anyway? Because the static checker, in my opinion, gives a lot of value.
Well, I think there's certainly several of aspects of what you mentioned in there. I think in the end, we are not the business people, and we are not making sort of the decisions about, how we're going to make money off of this. We like the technology. We're excited about enabling programmers to write better code, and so we sort of stay on the technical side and let other people make these decisions. So it's really not essentially it's not been our decision. And we don't really have full control over that.
Okay. So let's get into sort of how this system is used. Developers, when we first get in, developers seem to be generally confused at the start about when to use the static checker, when to use the runtime checker. They're two very fundamentally different things. You said before, static analysis and verification, I sometimes describe as being scaffolding around my code, because I can evaluate things sort of at build time. And then I think I have this metaphor in my mind of the runtime checker being more of a safety net below it at runtime in case things fall or break. They're very different things, and developers are looking for some advice about how to think about the static checker generally and how to think about the runtime checker. You have any advice there?
So maybe I'll just talk a little bit about how we use the tools in our own code phase and give you an idea from that perspective. So I think definitely if you want to use contracts, I think the first thing to do is enable the runtime checker. Okay, just enable a runtime checker, and wherever you think you need a contract, wherever you think about, should this be null, should this be non-negative, things like that, just write it down as a contract in your code. And what you get from that is you basically get early error detection during your test run. So you think about it in a similar form as you use asserts in your code, right? These are gates that say, okay, this shouldn't be happening at this point in my program's execution. And so that way you effectively augment the number of such checks in your code and hopefully during your testing you will run into them and find errors early on. And at the same time, this will already serve as documentation, right? And so the good thing about that approach is that you can write as little or as much of such specifications as you want. There's no cost in terms of you having to write a lot. You know, you can write only what you think should be there.
That's a good point. You know, the advice I've been giving people is when you start, you don't have to document everything. You have to start by documenting what you think's important and then come back and add more later if you feel it's important to do that.
Absolutely, and that's why I think one should start there. Right? One should start with the runtime checker only. So we've been using the tools on our own code base for implementing the tools, in fact. And so we are using the runtime checker on all the projects, and we've just started filling in these things. Now, when it comes to the static checker, I've sort of tried to focus my attention on certain parts of the code where I use the static checker. And, you know, you can control, for example, using the attributes called contract verification, you can control which parts of the code the static checker is actually going to look at. So I started using those attributes to focus the static checker on some particular classes that I thought were, you know, troublesome, or maybe I had more bugs in the past than in other places, and then trying to really nail down those parts by running the static checker on it, and then filling in all the missing specifications that the static checker was then pointing out to me.
How do you do that? You start by setting contract verification false at an assembly level and then true at a narrow level, like a method or a class level, and then working out? Or do you sort of start from the outside and work in? What's the best way to do that?
Oh, yeah, definitely the first thing you mentioned. So you set it to false on the assembly level, and then you start with a particular class, or even just a method, as you say, and then you work your way out. Exactly. That's what I do.
It's interesting because I worked with a tool years and years ago when I wrote C and C++ called Lint. Lint was a static analysis or verification tool that we could run at, sort of after the fact, or before actually, I guess, the object compile, to give us hints about things that could be wrong with the code potentially based on some best practices and patterns and things that have been codified over the years. And it was really overwhelming. You know, when you turn Lint loose on a base of source code, it could generate thousands or hundreds of thousands of warnings that made it almost impossible to get started.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that. And this is really a problem with every static analysis, right? And it's no different with the static checker for contracts. That if you just have an existing big project and you just let it loose all on it, it will overwhelm you. Which is why I think you want to start small, right? You want to focus on one particular smaller class initially that you think it's valuable to do it for, and then grow it outwards.
So you say start with the runtime checker. As I sort of have been describing, sort of put that safety net underneath. Document only what you think is important and then refine that over time. And then with respect to static analysis or the static checker, sort of work your way out of an assembly. Start by, you know, focusing on methods and classes, then and work your way out using that contract verification attribute. Is that the pattern you'd recommend?
That's exactly the pattern. Because one thing that happens, so if I focus on one particular class, right? I mean, that class, that the code in that class is going to call other methods from other places, right? That you may not want to run the static checker on yet, right? And you don't. So, but you might still need to write, say, some requires or ensures of these other methods that you're calling. And by using the static checker, it will point some of these things out to you. And then by writing those extra contracts on these other parts of your code that you're not running the static checker on, you're now increasing the runtime checking of those parts, right? So I think that's a good thing. Another thing I use it for example, is if you have, you use some library and it has, say, an indexing abstraction, right? You use some kind of list abstraction or something like that. And you want to make sure that some piece of code in your, that you want to statically analyze, uses that correctly, right? That is, it always indexes in bounds. Or then you can write a precondition that requires on that other library without doing the static analysis over there, and then, you know, run the static checker on your code, that calls that library and make sure it does the bounds indexing properly, right? So that's kind of how I use it, and I think this is really pretty effective so far, as long as you focus properly, because if you don't focus, then you get overwhelmed.
That's great. That's good advice. I appreciate that. Let's talk for a minute about testing. Another question I get a lot is, should I be testing my contracts?
Yeah, we do get this question a lot, and it's an interesting one. I think my reaction is always sort of trying to counter question first. I mean, the first counter question I would ask is, are you testing your asserts in your code?
Well, I typically don't, but I guess that's a good question to hand to the people who ask me that question. But it really comes down to the code paths that you're going to take and some of those questions that you have to answer early on, like, am I going to use the runtime support or not? And if the answer, I guess, is no, if you're not going to be using the runtime support for code contracts, does it really make sense to turn it on in a debug build or one that you would execute unit tests against?
Well, I think we didn't really touch on this aspect yet, but I think we should talk about this now, about which builds do you want to run the runtime checker on. So I think on the debug build, you should always run the runtime checker. Okay, you should always enable that on the debug builds. Whether you want to run it on the release build or not, now that's a totally different question, right? Effectively, once you release your code, you want to ask yourself, well, what checks do I still want to enforce in the release build, right? That is it a check that needs to be there because if it's not done, something really horrible will happen? Or if it's not there, well, it's just a bug that, you know, just like any other bug you might still have in your code that might still trigger, in your release build. So contracts are not going to prevent problems in your release build, right? They just point them out earlier. One of the things we have to get into is the issue of preconditions and what happens when the precondition is violated, right? Traditionally, people were told to do, parameter validation in the form, check the condition, and if it's not true, throw some particular argument exception or specialized type from that. And if you do that in your code, in your release build, it's not just like an assert, right? It's something that you advertise as being a functionality of this code. That is, you're saying, if you pass me, say, null, I will throw null exception, right? And that's a very specific behavior that you're now advertising to everybody. And people might say, oh, this is great. I'm actually going to rely on this behavior. I'm going to catch this null exception and do something in that case, right? So if you do that, you advertise way more behavior in your code than you might want to. It's very different from an assert, right? Nobody will rely on an assert. Nobody will say, oh, I'm going to hook into the assert handler, and if I pass null and this thing triggers, then I'm going to do something else, right? That's not behavior people will rely on. And so with contracts, you have to think of the same thing. If you're using preconditions, you have a choice. Do you want this to be advertised with a fixed behavior that is throwing a particular exception that people might rely on, or do you just want it to be documentation saying, don't call me with null, okay? And what happens when you call me with null is up to me, and you cannot rely on any behavior from that point on. Those are decisions that programmers have to make, and that will influence what kind of preconditions they write and how they use the tools.
Yeah, it's interesting. In languages like Java, which has the throws statement indicating which exceptions will be thrown by a bit of code, we can see, clearly that trying to use that for any kind of enforcement fails most of the time. People will just sort of ratchet up and deal with things at the highest exception level to make their code compile on the consuming side. And so in an attempt, I guess, to be, sort of documenting along the way, and somewhat contractual in the way it's specified, we can see that in some cases people are interested in treating those exceptions as part of a contract, and most of the time, consumers of the code are more interested in treating it like documentation. This is what could happen if you gave me the wrong information, for example, though if you gave me a null that I didn't expect. So I've always thought that the .NET way of handling that, by not really having a throws statement in C#, for example, it was good in some respects because it didn't sort of force us to think that, hey, this is contractual in nature. But it did leave out a flavor in the language, you know, per se, that gave us a hook for at least expressing. You know, when you write those legacy-style if-then-throw preconditions or if-then-throw statements that we can convert to preconditions with code contracts, before code contracts, they were really sort of inside the body of the function that was going to execute, and I had no way of conveying that outside of the method. Code contracts for the first time give me a way of conveying that. And it's conveyed in a way that the consumer can choose to honor it or use it or not. That's sort of how I look at it. Is that a fair way to look at it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's very good.
One of the things that when you talk about testability of contracts, the first thing that you know usually pops up is someone will try to write a unit test around a failing contract, a failure case, and they'll try to put an expected exception of contract exception in their unit test. And, of course, they immediately realize, I can't get this unit test to compile because I can't find the contract exception class. You guys have made that internal. What was your thinking there?
Well, I think so this is really exactly why we had this discussion about what happens at runtime when you validate a precondition and do you advertise a particular exception to be thrown or not, right? And I think effectively I try to tell people, well, if you write your contracts in the form where you have if-then-throws with particular exceptions or the requires with the exception argument, then you do advertise what exactly should happen at runtime if you fail this precondition and you say here's the exception that's going to be thrown. So feel free to write tests against that because you actually are advertising what's going to happen and that should be the behavior and it should be the same behavior in all builds, right? Now, and for that you can do it with the existing unit test technology because those exceptions you're going to be throwing are actually the advertised ones and they're not the internal hidden contract exception. If you use just the requires without the particular exceptions, then it's more in the debug flavor as said before, in assert flavor as I talked about before, which means are you testing your debug asserts, right? Are you writing test cases to trigger them? And I think nobody does, and I think you shouldn't be doing that either. If you don't advertise what the behavior of a failed precondition should be, then you shouldn't test for it.
At the same time, we actually do give people the ability to wire in their own behavior for a failing contract. So if they absolutely, I mean, Manuel's pointing out what our position is, but we try to also just provide the infrastructure so that people can make their own policy decisions. And so there are multiple ways to control the behavior of a failing contract. And so if you really do want to write unit tests against failing contracts, you can use those different hooks to control what the behavior is, and then you can deal with that in your unit tests.
Are you talking specifically about custom rewriter?
Okay, I'm not sure. So by custom rewriter, what I mean is one part of the tooling is we allow you to define your own behavior for failing contracts, and those are free to throw whatever exceptions you want or to write things to logs or do whatever behavior you want. In particular, they can throw exceptions that your unit tests are expecting to see.
There's a validator, a custom validator. Is that what you're talking about?
No. We're talking about the fact that you can define at runtime, right, whenever you wrote a contract, requires, insures, or so on, there will be a particular method getting called at runtime. Usually we generate those methods. They're called, system contracts _ contract runtime requires and so on. And typically those that we generate automatically for you, those throw this internal contract exception, right, if they fail. Now you're free to provide these methods yourself in your build. So there's a special option in the settings for the runtime check.
Oh, yes, 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 without having to do that through a rewriter.
That's right. You can
right.
say,
that's right.
Well, you have to use the rewriter to make this work. But
I think to wire it up.
Yes, but you can
right.
say here's the class and that contains these runtime methods, right? And then the rewriter will emit code that calls your methods for all these checks, right? And then what you do in those methods is up to you. That is, you can check the condition, you can log, you can throw if the condition is not true, you can do whatever you want, right? And so, in fact, obviously for our own tools, right, we have to test our tools, and of course for our purpose, because we're, you know, testing whether the tools do the right thing, we have to, of course, check in our unit tests whether the right failure happens for particular contracts, right, for all of them, in fact, right? And so in order to test that, we use that feature. That is, we have our own runtime failure methods, and they throw particular exceptions that we then use in our unit tests, right? But that's different because we're checking the tools themselves. We're not checking a use of the tools.
Right. So other than wiring up the custom handlers, do you see any other uses, interesting uses for rewriters that are appearing sort of in the public space? Anybody really using that capability for anything other than that?
Sure. I mean, there's tons of uses for binary rewriting, and well, there's lots of tools out there in the world that do different things of binary rewriting. But do you mean that relating to contracts?
Yes, relating to contracts.
Well, I mean, we just
wanted to make it possible for people if they had this need. We didn't want it to lock them out. But
right.
I'm not sure that a lot of people use that feature now.
All right, so let's move on then and talk a bit about the static checker in continuous integration builds. It's something that I know people ask about, and I'm sure you get the question. If I'm using the static checker, you know, as you said in the past, start with the runtime checker, sort of graduate to the static checker. But if from there you decide to include it and have it emit warnings that you might want to potentially promote to errors in a continuous integration build, I guess if your code is solid enough that you've handled everything and you feel comfortable putting the static checker in a continuous integration build, is that something you'd even recommend?
Well, I mean, we do this in our own continuous integration build, and I think once you are comfortable with it and you have your focus of your static checker in a way that makes it work for people, then feel free to use it in your continuous integration build. That's fine. I suppose you're asking, well,
sure.
how do I make sure that my build fails when some new warning comes up? Is that what you're asking about?
Right. Yeah. So for example, in Visual Studio, if you promote warnings to errors, the code contracts warnings from the static checker don't seem to get promoted. And I've just wondered myself if you all did something special to make that true, or if it's just because it's sort of running after the compiler.
This is just because it's separate from the compiler, right? So the problem with the treat warnings as errors is ideally this would be something that the infrastructure around all the tools does, for example, Studio, right? But in fact, it is not. It is something that it's an option that gets passed down to the compiler, the C-sharp compiler or the VB compiler and so on. And then the compiler decides based on that whether to succeed or fail, right? And we haven't wired that up to our tools because, in fact, we wanted to make sure that we didn't break builds based on things that might come up in our tools. Because that might be annoying to certain people. So that said, it is still possible to use the static checker as a integration gate, but you have to use, I think there was a post in the forum about this, and I think I explained how to do it, which is that you have to use the baseline compilation feature, which is a way to say, okay, here's a set of errors or warnings that I expect from the static checker. Warn me and fail the build if any extra failures happen, right? And so if you can use that feature to actually get the gate going and fail your build if you're not passing those checks.
Yeah, personally, I would not want to break my builds, but I get the question from time to time, and people seem to want to know if one, why doesn't it break the bill when you promote warnings to errors today? And two, sort of how we would do that. I remember reading that post on the forum about the baseline feature to do that. Is there any plan in the future to potentially wire that into to MS Build so you could promote it?
Well, it certainly would be doable. I think if there's a big demand for that, we should just keep it a separate option from the warnings errors, because that option is really a C# or VB compiler option. It's not a general option, right? For example, that option does not apply to code analysis, which is the standard built-in code analysis that comes with Studio. It doesn't apply to that either, right?
Yeah, that's right. Okay. I want to talk a bit about coding style and contract architecture. You know, there are different ways to sort of express preconditions. There, we have a standard requires call, a generic requires that takes an exception type, which could be thrown, and then those legacy style if-then-throw exceptions that you could promote by ending a contract block after them. With respect to the different types of preconditions, is there a recommended pattern for which ones to use? You know, there are issues, for example, around inheritance of if-then-throw style, you know, the legacy style preconditions, whereas you might not have those issues using the new style, the ones that are part of the framework contract class. What advice could you give to people about picking a precondition style based on, you know, your runtime, the runtime support that you're going after versus the, you know, what you might be doing at build time?
Well, yeah, this is a question that's important, and I think we actually have a whole section in the documentation, you know, trying to address this issue. And I think it goes back to some of the things we discussed earlier about what do you want to happen at runtime in your release build for certain failed preconditions, right? And I think you have to make this decision as a programmer in terms of what am I going to, what behavior do I want there? So, I think in the documentation we point at sort of three scenarios that make sense to us, but you know there are possibly more. So one is the first scenario, which is maybe the simplest one, is that you say, oh, I don't care about my release bits. They're not going to throw, say, particular exceptions for preconditions, right? If you're in that camp, then you can just use requires everywhere, the simplest form, and you use it on your build, on your debug builds. But on your release builds, there will be no checking for these. If you do that, then that's sort of the simplest approach, and you don't really run into any particular problems. The second approach is no, I do have some need for runtime failures in my release builds, and I want to throw particular exceptions. Okay, so now you have a choice, right? You can say, okay, I don't want to run the tools on the release build. Okay, I don't want to run the rewriter, the runtime instrument on the release build. If that's your choice, which you might want to do because you don't want to take the risk of it, you know, adding bad code or something like that due to bugs in our tools, which is a reasonable choice, then you have the issue that you need to use the legacy requires form. Okay, you have to, you know, use the legacy form and say if then, and then throw the particular exception that you want.
And you have to perform contract inheritance manually. So you have to go, if you introduce such a precondition in a virtual base method, then any override, you'll need to do that by yourself and add that.
Because the tools are not running, exactly. And so that's why we distinguish that form from, say, the other form, which is the requires with the exception, which you can use if you're willing to run the rewriter on your release builds, because then you get the tooling to do the inheritance and so on for you.
Yeah, that's an interesting distinction. That reading some great documentation in the code contracts manual, but getting to the point where at least I understood early on that inheritance was going to be up to me if I chose the legacy style. Was something that didn't really jump out of the documentation, I should say.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is something we sort of iterated on and found sort of an approach over time, because it wasn't clear initially, you know, how to solve all these demands from every side, right? I mean, having to have a support for contracts in a way that makes sense, even if you don't run the rewriter eventually on the release bits, right? That was always an issue. And I think we now, you know, came to the following, to the current situation because we want to make sure that there's no surprises at runtime in your release builds, okay? That is, we don't want it to be the case that the behavior in the release build is vastly different with respect to advertised exceptions than in your debug build.
Right.
That's sort of the main point. So if we did the legacy inheritance automatically using the tools, then if you run them, if you run the tools, you might inherit some exceptions and some checks, and then you turn the tools off for your release build, and now the behavior will be different, right? And we try to avoid that.
Yeah, that's excellent. Very good. So one of the other things that pops up a lot is we have generic requires that will of a particular exception type, but there's no insurers of an exception type. What's the reason for that, or is there a plan for potentially changing that in the future?
Well, we only have the requires with a specific exception type to cater to the fact that people were using code contracts to retrofit them onto code that had already been written and that had already been advertising these specific exceptions for precondition failures. In general, people have not written postconditions, so there we're starting with a clean slate, and we can sort of we can stay true to our, you know, ideal vision where contract errors should not be advertising specific exceptions.
Right.
The other point for a postcondition is that a postcondition is a failure of the method implementation. And, you know, of course, by the time you ship your code is all perfect, and you don't need to have your shipping. Your release build shouldn't have to ever check the postcondition.
That's true. It's true if you're working with a sort of a monolithic code base, but if you're using, you know, Python or Ruby for scripting in the middle of a large rules engine framework, for example, you may not know exactly what the rules are that are going to run in the middle of something that was statically verified early on. So, but excellent observation. I was pretty sure that was your reasoning. It is a question that comes up a lot, though. Why is there no insurers of a particular exception generically, and why is there no invariant of exception type?
It's really the same reason that there's no debug assert with a particular exception.
That's a good point. We're in the home stretch here. Let's talk a bit about documentation. Now, of course, we've talked about code contracts being documentation, but of course, there's human-readable documentation also that we want to be able to emit. And there is a sandcastle patch, is that right, that ships with code contracts?
Yeah, so one part of the tools that I mentioned early on was the documentation generation. And by that, what I mean is that if you turn on the XML doc capabilities in your project properties, namely that you're having the compiler generate an XML file that contains the metadata and the information from your /// comments, then the code contracts will augment that XML file with custom tags and information about the contracts in your code. Then it's up to downstream tools to make use of that XML. And as an example of what can be done, we have, as part of the code contracts installation, you get a sandcastle patch that makes sandcastle's generated documentation contain formatted sections about contracts. But really, the main point is that now we've encoded the contracts into the XML file, and any downstream tool that processes the XML can take advantage of that.
And those schema changes, if you will, to the XML, are they documented anywhere other than the patch for sandcastle?
I don't believe so. Yeah, we could.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Maybe that's an oversight on our part.
Yeah, we probably
should be in the doc. Yeah.
Well, no, I was just thinking about third-party tools other than Sandcastle that might want to take the extended XML and potentially consume that to produce, you know, their own documentation.
Right. We should document. That's a good point. Thank you.
No problem. So Sandcastle, now let's talk about that for a minute. Do you all use Sandcastle internally on some or all of your projects?
Yeah, I mean, we've used it on some projects. We don't often produce externally visible documentation.
Right. One of the issues, I guess, and that when I talk about this to people, is they say, well, Sandcastle hasn't really seen any changes in quite some time, and they're worried about, you know, potentially support of it in the future. It seems like with code contracts, there's a very good reason for now starting to focus on, you know, better and more up-to-date documentation tools. Is Sandcastle going to see an update in the future that you know of, or do you guys have any plans for a documentation tool related to code contracts that might be out there sort of lurking in the future?
So we've communicated our patches to the Sandcastle team. You know, I don't know. I don't have any information about what their plans are or whether they're going to update the base implementation to include the contract support. In terms of future, what we've been working on lately and we're hoping to release soon is Visual Studio 2010 has a new extensibility model, and a member of our team, Daryl Zuniga, has written several extensions so that you get more documentation in the IDE as you're using it. Namely, we are enriching the quick info and signature helper bubbles that pop up while you're hovering over a member in the IDE or typing a method call, so that you see not only the name of the method and the arguments and the XML documentation about them, but also you'll see the contracts.
Oh, that's great. That's exactly the kind of thing that I've been looking for. You know, knowing we talk about obligations in contracts, right? I have an arithmetic obligation or a non-null obligation, things like that. It'd be really nice to sort of see those obligations at the point that you're writing the code.
Exactly.
Yeah, that was definitely missing so far. So we hope to release that pretty soon. And the other thing it will do for you is if you go to definition on some library methods, and then the IDE synthesizes for you these APIs, right, where you can see how they look. And we augment those too with contracts, so you can actually see the contracts that are there.
Any time frame on when we might see that extension, and is it going to potentially appear on in the Visual Studio gallery?
We're hoping to get it out soon. Maybe, I don't know, maybe a month, maybe more, but hopefully within the next month. And yeah, we'd probably put it on the gallery, I guess, or it'd probably be part of the tools that comes with the install. I'm not sure.
I mean, do people use the gallery? Is that something how you would find this extension?
I do. I know a lot of people now that the power tools, the pro power tools and all those are out, and with, you know, updates that are coming rather frequently, Visual Studio Gallery tool section in particular is a pretty hot topic these days.
Try that.
That's where we'll do it then. Okay.
Okay. I had one more section I wanted to talk about, or one more topic, and that is PECs. There is some level of PECs, the Microsoft Program Explorer, I guess it's called in the larger sense, with code contracts. I was hoping you guys would just sort of talk about PECs integration for a bit as a way to wrap up.
Yeah, sounds good, yeah. So PECs obviously is another really great tool from Microsoft Research. And there is some integration that we've done between PECs and contracts. But in fact, the nice thing was that we didn't have to do a lot, because simply that if you enable the runtime checking, now your code contains contracts and possible failures, and PECs automatically takes advantage of trying to, you know, find ways to violate them. So that was sort of done in a way that we didn't have to do a lot of integration. Where the integration comes in is the fact that when you say, run PECs on a particular method that has actual preconditions, then the one thing that the integration does for you is PECs understands what these preconditions are, and if it finds inputs to your test method that violate the preconditions, then it knows that those are not really failures in the test. Those are actually expected, right? Because, you know, you're not supposed to pass me that data anyway. And so that's kind of as far as the integration goes on the require side. The other thing that PECs takes advantage of is if you write data invariants using contract invariant methods, PECs uses those to try to synthesize objects that actually satisfy your data invariants. And so that helps PECs get better data for objects that needs to synthesize for the tests that it does.
Invariants, I've often said that from my perspective as a coder writing, you know, software day in and day out, invariants are a great way for me to make sure that future changes to my code don't break it, don't break obligations or expectations about how it's used. Because if I can say in general, this is what must be true about the code from a public interface perspective, then attempts to change that are sort of easy to recognize globally, not necessarily within the within a particular function, but essentially all public methods within the class. And PEX, it sounds like, is really tapping into that, tapping in and looking at it the same way. It's, you know, looking, here's an invariant, and then essentially all the public methods across that class, it could make assumptions about looking for the cases to satisfy those invariants.
Yeah, right, and that's done automatically because simply we instrument the checks for the invariant at all the public methods, and so PEX will try to violate them and maybe find ways to do that.
So PEX then, is PEX looking at the rewritten code to do that, or is it looking at the invariant at compile time?
It actually looks at the rewritten code, and because we instrumented everything into the rewritten code, it sort of sees all the checks there automatically, yeah.
So I really need to enable the runtime tools to make this integration work well.
Absolutely. So the way you do it is enable the runtime checking, yes.
Okay. That's great.
Sorry, we just wanted to point out that there's a new website up called www.pexforfun.com. Something that Telly and Nikolai put up to try to enable programmers to play with PEX and contracts. It's just a web interface where you can type a piece of code, has a bunch of samples as well, and you can submit, and it says it runs PEX on the server and code contracts and gives you feedback. So it's a way to play with the tools without having to install them.
I'm glad you mentioned that because I would have forgotten. I actually found that site yesterday through a friend's something on Twitter and tried it out, and it's fantastic. So it's pexforfun.com.
Yep, that's exactly right.
Yeah, that's excellent. Yeah, it really is a great way to sort of experiment with the tools without having to go through the cost of installing things.
Yes, that's the idea.
Well, that's great. So that's all the questions I had for today. In closing, do you all want to say anything about code contracts and where you guys are looking at going in the future?
Well, first off, we just would really like to thank you for doing the interview and writing the blog postings you've been writing, and we'd really love to thank everyone out there who's been using it because the entire direction of the project has evolved greatly because of the feedback we've gotten on the forum and from people mailing to us. So that's been great. You know, we're hopeful that in the future the contract tools will become more tightly integrated into the products, and we hope that they help people, you know, program better and get more feedback from the tools to help them make sure their code works better.
But yeah, keep the feedback coming. I think we are very open to hearing what you guys think about contracts.
That's great. Yeah, it's been my pleasure to participate. I really want to thank you all, Mike and Manuel, for participating today. That's it for this show. I'll talk to you guys soon. And as Mike and Manuel said, please visit the forums on the MSDN social site and give them some great feedback, and that will certainly help shape the product going forward. Mike and Manuel, thanks again.
Thanks.
Thank you, Kevin.
Take care.